Nah, not those Lions. Three Lions we can get behind.
And he hoofed it.
There's more pressure being ratcheted up with a loss like that, of course.
Just getting the head boxed off, should that just kind of happen.
For all your Lions coverage this summer, download the OTB Sports app.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power's Save Our Game. England's goals totaled 110k for Irish football. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now, you're very welcome back. So, 48 hours on from England, Italy, the fallout is focusing very much on the scenes in London, and particular at Wembley. A feral, out of control atmosphere as opposed to one of celebration, seemingly no security in place to keep things in check. And then those scenes followed by the almost inevitable racist abuse directed at the three English players who missed the penalties. All in all, they have combined to completely undercut what should have been an occasion for great national coming together. We have Matt Slater of The Athletic with us. Hi, Matt. How you doing?
Hi, how are you?
Good. Lots to talk about here. I might just kick things off with Gabriele Marcotti, who's going to be on our football show after 9 o'clock. We spoke to Gab just before coming on air. He was at Wembley and he was describing the scenes to us, and he was mentioning some friends of his, a family who had paid a lot of money for their tickets, and they arrived at their designated arrival time because there were staggered entry times given the COVID situation, and they arrived to find four blokes in their seats and they weren't of a mind to move, and it left the family in a fairly tricky situation. Mentioned it to stewards. The stewards didn't seem to be able to do much, and that situation was mirrored right across the stadium. It seems there's no talk of thousands having got into Wembley. Here is a sense, though, of Gabriele Marcotti speaking to us just about the situation at large. Have a listen.
I really hope there is an inquiry and people are held to account on a personal level. I don't like the fact that, you know, a Wembley spokesman talks to my ESPN colleagues and issues a statement, around 6:30 and says, oh, there was an incident with fans trying to get in, but you know, there was no security breach and no ticketless fans are inside the stadium. I'm sorry, man. You're like the Iraqi Minister of Information. You, sir, are a liar. And whether you're willingly lying, whether you're doing it, you know, because that is the bunk information you were given by your bosses, who are too chicken crap to come out and even have the balls to say, we're still investigating what's going on. We want to ascertain the facts first. That's simply unacceptable. I want names. I want people to come out. This country obviously has a history of terrible things happening at stadiums. And I know Wembley's not Hillsborough, but there's no telling what might have happened. As far as the stuff happening on Wembley Way, I watched the videos like you did. I am a bit shocked, but maybe I shouldn't have been, because similar scenes happened before the Denmark game and the Germany game. And, you know, I accept there is a portion of the support that will always behave this way. I didn't think they would do it. You know, I could see them doing it on away trips because I've seen them doing it on away trips. Didn't quite expect that they would do it, you know, in their home where they live. But even then, I got to take it back to the police. I can't deal with the police continually saying about how clever they are and how safe their stadiums are, and we've got this wonderful football intelligence, and look, you know, we stamped out hooliganism or whatever. Because you know what? On the day, you weren't there. And on the day, a lot of people were scared. A lot of bad things happened. A lot of worse things could have happened. And you need to do a full inquiry as well, you know. You're very good at going to people at the Sarah Everard vigil and taking candles off of middle-aged women and threatening to arrest them and carting them away. How about you man up and go and deal with it? And don't tell me that there were 300. The minimum security requirement was 300 police and there were 450. You know what? Maybe you're not that smart. Maybe 450, maybe that shouldn't be the minimum security requirement. Maybe all your clever people or experts in crowd control got that one wrong. How about you come out and own it? How about you come out and say, we done screwed up? You know, because you can't just come out and say, oh, there was a situation and we dealt with it. What the hell did you deal with? I mean, I'm sorry if I get a little annoyed, but, you know, I feel for all the fans who were there, whether they were supporting England or Italy. I feel for the other fans who went up and didn't have tickets and just thought that they would soak up the atmosphere peacefully and have a drink on Wembley Way. Because these guys screwed it up for everyone.
Gab Marcotti there. Gab's going to be on our football show. Ostensibly, the plan had been to talk to him about Italy, which we do, but naturally the scenes at Wembley came up and he was, as you can hear, pretty angry about the whole thing. Matt, at this stage, so 48 hours on, two things are apparent. One, this situation could have been so much worse. I hadn't really understood the numbers that we're talking. Thousands, it seems like, got into Wembley. And then secondly, the big conversation seems to be who's to blame? Who is to blame? Who let the ball drop in particular here?
That's a really good question, that last one. This is the problem, right? It is a multi-agency failure. Policing of crowds, policing of matches at Wembley is complicated because you have the stadium operator, you have the responsibility of the people that own the building, if you like. That's pretty clear where their responsibility begins and ends. You'd think so anyway, wouldn't you? Then you have the public streets. That is clearly the responsibility, most of the time, of the police. It's in Brent Council. So Brent Council, the part of London, clearly has a say. The Greater London Authority clearly has a say, as do various other agencies that you would expect at any major event. So already you've got a few voices there. You've got UEFA. It was UEFA's competition. Okay, you know, they're running the game, if you like. They're selling the tickets, but they're not running the logistics of the stadium. That is the owner. That's Wembley. The FA, ultimately, is a subsidiary of the FA. So you've got a slightly complicated picture there, but it's not that complicated. I mean, this wasn't the first game that the FA have staged. This wasn't the first game, this first big occasion that Wembley has staged. There are big games, big events played everywhere, every day. So what happened? Well, Gab has explained it pretty well there. I wasn't there. I was following it at home. I was watching at home with my family. And I was, you know, I'm a news guy, so I was sort of following on social media the events. I had friends there, colleagues there. And I spent pretty much all day yesterday on the phone. I must have had 20, 25 conversations more today. Some people that have been around the block, you know, not members of the Fun Police, people that have been seen, been to places, been in scary crowds. And I would say one of the things I've probably heard, 75-80% of people said it was the worst experience they've ever had at a sporting event. People, like I said, who couldn't look after themselves, telling me they were terrified, that it was sort of Lord of the Flies, like a kind of near riot for about 4 or 5 hours. Several lines were crossed at about noon. A complete breakdown in public order at around 5-6 when the sort of storming of the stadium started. Terrible scenes in and around the doors, the concourses. Unbelievable COVID breaches, violence, racism, sexual assault. I was pretty upset about losing on penalties, but by yesterday afternoon, I was utterly depressed and despondent about my country. To the point where, yeah, I wouldn't want a World Cup. I'm not sure we deserve it. I'm not sure. I'm frightened that we'd end up humiliating ourselves.
Yeah, it's such a sad snapshot of where England is in 2021 Sunday.
I think as sports journalists, you sort of kind of got to be careful, you know, about sort of sometimes going down that road. Because look, you know, the policing of big football games, big England games, this is not new. They're very, very hard to manage. And there were a combination of unusual factors about yesterday. I think we do have to acknowledge that. England hadn't made a final for 55 years. It was an 8 p.m. kickoff on a Sunday. People have been cooped up for 18 months. They haven't been going to live events. The country is at an unusual time in its history. Mm. The police were stretched. They had to police fan parks. They had to police the pubs in their own towns. There is a long-running issue between football and the police around the bill. Not the bill as in the police. I mean, the bill, who pays for them, right? Mm. Now, I would imagine if I was a copper, I would have wanted double, triple time. I quite like to have watched the game myself at home. Mm. So if I was expected to turn up at Wembley, I would want to be paid for that. Who's going to pay for that bill? So, you know, Gab mentioned the numbers. We still haven't actually had that confirmed. They're refusing to answer my questions about it. And I will have to go down the freedom of information route on that one. We'll see what comes of that. There are at least two investigations that have started. So weird number of specific factors, but let's frame it then in history. You know, Wembley and big occasions at Wembley have seen this before. The White Horse final, what was it, 75,000-80,000 extra fans there that day back in the 20s. I was actually at the 1986 Cup final, Liverpool-Everton, as a young boy. I went to the Milk Cup final as well. I remember lots of people bunking in that day. We know that jibbing has sort of entered the parlance in the last 48 hours. Tailgating was a big issue at the 2011 Champions League final. The new Wembley has a reputation for being a soft touch. That's probably been underreported.
Right.
That's not something we've discussed enough.
Right.
Sunday started on Wednesday. Sunday started with Denmark. Hundreds now, I think, got into that game, and word got round in the area, but got round on social media as well. It got round in WhatsApp groups. And I suppose there was something quite, again, unique about the circumstances. If you think about tailgating, and I've had long conversations with stewards about this, with FA staff, Wembley staff about this, ordinarily what they will say is, yes, at any sporting occasion, like just as you would on the tube or public transport, you will get some people that successfully get through tailgating. If any of your viewers, listeners aren't aware what that is, you follow someone with a ticket really, really closely behind them, you get through the turnstile. And what you tend to do then is you have a sort of second line of defense inside and you grab them and you throw them out. I see that at games. And normally at Wembley, that would be pretty easy because it's a sellout. Where are they going to sit? You had 45,000 empty seats at Denmark. You had 30,000 in theory at Germany. Word got round. If you can get in, you'll be okay, because you will not have the issue of the, well, where's your ticket, mate? You're out. So that again is a slightly unusual element to the weekend. So you have all this. And I, you know, as I'm explaining this to you now, I feel like I'm rationalizing it and putting it in context. And to a degree, I am over some elements of it. Mm. But what happened between about 11-ish, noon-ish, and 6 outside Wembley is a national scandal that goes beyond football. It's a societal issue. A great big mirror was held up to us, and it was very, very ugly. Very ugly. Mm. And it was not a minority. That's the standard defense, right? Of England behaving poorly abroad. It was awful. Awful. And the pictures, I'm led to believe, you know, as I said, I've spoken to dozens. I've had messages this afternoon from mates of mine who were there. Awful. They said awful. Feral. A riot.
Mm. And underpinned by, and this is not exceptional to England, by the way, but underpinned by our relationship as human beings with drink and drugs.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Yeah, like I said, you know, it came up a few times, you know, there's a fine line, okay, in big crowds, you know, kind of stag do type mentality. And I think when football gets it right, it's funny. Mm. If you're in it, if you're involved in it,
yeah,
you think you're funny. And I'm not a saint, and I don't want to sanitize football. I really don't. But the number of people, and it's sort of 100% actually of the people I've spoken to that said that no, that was it was different. It was not funny. It was nearly funny, and then there's an edge. I don't like this and that. Why are people throwing? And traffic cones at 1 o'clock Why are they kicking that window? What? Why are they tipping over the portaloo? You know, what are we doing? You know, why are we racially abusing stewards? Why are we fighting each other at 2 p.m? Just what's going on? Is this funny? This doesn't seem funny. This seems like just loutery, hooliganism.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to diagnose from afar, obviously, but it's some kind of pent-up frustration and anger, and it's a time to let it all out, and it's an opportune time to just behave with complete abandon and to lash out and to throw bottles, as you said, and abuse. And there's a degree of anonymity and immunity about the whole thing, and so people just go for it. That's that atmosphere takes hold, I suppose, and that's a human thing. Like, I wouldn't judge that in certain ways, because people let their frustrations out in different ways, even as ugly as it got at times. But it's the absence, I suppose, of the adults in the room, the police, to just keep it in line. And I saw the FA chairman put this squarely on the police, didn't literally say it, but he was asked about this yesterday, what is the story here with everything that was going on? And he said, look, stadium, that's us, sure.
Yeah.
But he said, Wembley Way, that's a public order situation, 100%. So you read between the lines, he was saying, Once Wembley Way 6 o'clock was unleashed on our stadium, we were up against it. And how the hell Wembley Way was allowed to develop the way it did, that's not on us. But he was basically saying, Priti Patel, Boris, police, that's all you.
Yeah. So look, there's lots to unpack there. So, like I said, it's a shared responsibility. It's a multi-agency approach. So the way safety, large events are governed in the UK, and it's pretty similar around the world. This is not unique. You have what you call a safety advisory group. You know, you hear the SAG, you hear it quite a lot, and that would be your local authority. It would involve the police, it might involve fire brigade, etc. Come on to meetings, and they would basically certify your stadium. They'd certify your event. It's an ongoing process. You do risk assessments. You work out, you know, how many do you think we need for this? It's a church fete. I reckon we're going to be okay. I'm having a rave. All right, okay. That's how are we going to do that? Where the loos? Where are people going to park? Have you spoken to the hospital? But all right, standard stuff. Not that complicated. Obviously, you know, booze, alcohol, you know, that sort of thing. Big numbers, gets more complicated. Wembley is, first of all, you know, London is a first world city. It's a wealthy place. Wembley has hosted major events, NFL, 2 Champions Leagues. It's hosted 8 games in this tournament. It is a new stadium. For what happened to have happened, and for people to be sort of going, your fault, my fault, this is where my responsibility ends, just isn't good enough. It's just, hold on a minute, you've built this massive, great national stadium, second biggest sports stadium in Europe. You want major events. What? Sorry, you can't police. You can't sort out a plan between the tube station there. And how do you think people get here? I mean, so that's not good enough to do the. Here's my line. I'll put my stewards here. What? No. There has to be a little bit of how you get A to B. So this is what needs to come out. And what I am learning is there's been tension around Wembley for a while. It goes right back to the building of the new Wembley. The FA lost control of the budget. They lost control of the footprint, if you like. They didn't have enough money for car parking. It's a weirdly inaccessible part of London, given that the whole debate was where it has to be in London, can't be in Coventry. Well, they've ironically chosen quite an inaccessible part of London. So you always had issues there. How people get there, how people congregate, what do they do? The area around Wembley has just been filled up now in a very kind of ad hoc, disorganized sort of way. Loads of student housing, loads of restaurants and bars that didn't used to be there. The stations are there. There's a few stations, but none of them are actually that good. None of them are good and big enough. So who pays for that, though? Is that an FA? Is that on them? No, not really. But should it be contributing? So right back from the beginning of this project, there's been issues that only really come out when something goes wrong. Now, something went wrong on Sunday, and I think it is time to have a look at all this again. Mm. You know, who is responsible for Wembley Way? Who is responsible for Arena Square? I don't want to get bogged down in too many bits, but it's more than just that bit, that thoroughfare you can see. Yes, it all goes around to the right. If you're looking down that shot, the classic shot they do of the arch, imagine you're looking down there. It goes around to the right. There's a big shopping mall there now. It's where the arena is. It's where pretty much it all kicks off these days, to be honest. It's become a sort of hangout place. And you might have a band there and you might put a screen there, but none of that was there. You know, the screen wasn't there anyway. So there is clearly a shared responsibility about that. And then you have to be able to get those people, safely move them, if they're ticket holders, into the ground. Again, shared responsibility. So that all broke down. There weren't enough police there. The stewarding, the FA are hanging on this sort of, look, we had more there from very previous game. Okay, but what are we talking? £8 an hour and a high-vis jacket? What sort of training have they had? You know, how are they motivated? What sort of support have they got? You know, I who's looking after them today? Because a lot of injuries, a lot of abuse, sort of people be shaken up. But what sort of training have they had? Should there be more police inside the ground? What's your infrastructure like? What's your sort of, you know, how are your queues?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm hearing it all. Experts on stadiums are saying, wait a minute, you know, clubs deal with big crowds, right? We can safely get people in and out, right? We have tailgating issues. This is how we deal with tailgating. I'm not sure the FA is absolutely best practice.
Yeah.
I think there's real tension between them and the police and the council about these shared areas.
Yeah, complicated picture. Listen, we're right out of time, but Matt Slater from The Athletic, thanks so much. Brilliant stuff, Matt. Appreciate it.
No problem.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power's Save Our Game. England's goals totaled 110k for Irish football. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to play my country again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Yeah, we got a good football show for you this evening. Marcelo Moura-Iorahu will join us later on to talk about success for Lionel Messi at last. But first, there is more to discuss when it comes to the Euros. We talked a lot about England yesterday, not too much about the actual champions in Italy. So to do so, very happy to say, we have Gabriele Marcotti on the line. Gab, how you doing? Thanks for the time.
Great, thanks for having me on.
It was a brilliant game, we should say, on Sunday, by the way. Wasn't it thoroughly absorbing right from the off?
I thought so. I thought it was interesting to see, since we want to talk more, you said we want to talk more about Italy, how, you know, having taken that, you know, they say there's that Mike Tyson quote about everybody having a plan until they get punched in the face. And Mancini goes out there with his plan and gets punched in the face, metaphorically, after 2 minutes with a Luke Shaw goal. And little by little, Italy worked their way back in, and he makes substitutions, moving Insigne into central position, sending on Berardi as well, to really go and, you know, and obviously taking off Immobile, to go and moving to that diamond to kind of give themselves get themselves back into the game, create a bunch of chances, get the equalizer, and really I thought they were on top most of the rest of the way. Now, you know, we don't want to go down the England route because you guys have talked too much about England, but I'm sure some people will say, well, was it Mancini being clever or was it Southgate kind of being piss poor and, you know, offering a rerun of 2018 against Croatia?
And where are you on that spectrum?
I think both things can be true. But the one thing, I mean, I have trouble criticizing Southgate because I really like him as a person. I've said many times, though, he's a far better person than he is a football manager. He stayed true to his ideals of setting up Uber defensively in this tournament, went even further in the final by adding Kieran Trippier and taking off one other attacking player. And look, if you want to play games where, you know, you go out and you defend yourself with eight men, and I'm adding Mason Mount to that because all he was asked to do was basically go and press the Italy midfield and just attack with, you know, Harry Kane and Raheem Sterling and nobody else when, you know, you've got Sancho and Foden and Grealish and God knows what else on the bench, then, you know, that's your call. I think it's wrong. I think the fact that I think he did it because he saw that France won a World Cup playing essentially that day. Well, that way. Mm. Well, the big difference, of course, is that France had Mbappe and the 2018 version of Griezmann and Paul Pogba setting them up in midfield, and England didn't.
Mm. On Mancini, so I take your point on the substitutions on the night. Big picture, what has he done so well over the last couple of years? Because I think everybody is well aware at this stage, Italy were not at the World Cup in 2018, which was just an unthinkable low ebb for a country like Italy. So big picture, what's Mancini done here, Gab?
So I think big picture, there's really two things that spring to mind. One is, I know it's a cliche, and when teams go and win, obviously everybody gets along and it's a band of brothers. But literally every Italy player you talk to emphasize that point over and over again. So I tend to believe them. He really created a tremendous, tremendous group of players who trusted each other, who got along with each other. There was zero controversy over playing time, even when, you know, things got a little wobbly, even when people lost their place, like Berardi or Florenzi relative to the first game, like Locatelli as well. You know, that was obviously really, really big. And I think the other thing, though, more practically on the pitch, is Mancini looked around and said, all right, what works in modern football? You know, what kind of football do the best teams, the ones we admire, the most successful ones, what kind of football do they play? And they play like Manchester City, or they play like Bayern Munich, or they play like Liverpool. They demand the ball. They want the ball. They defend high up the pitch to try to get it back. They're aggressive, and they try to get as many of their talented players on the pitch as possible. Kind of the opposite, come to think of it, of the Gareth Southgate approach. Mm. Now that works at club level, but he said, let's try to do this with a national team. You know, we have an opportunity here because we don't have that many superstars right now. We have a situation where maybe for the first time in their history, Italy's best players were in central midfield, their most talented players, not up front and not at the back. Obviously, Benucci and Chiellini were great players, and they were great again in the tournament, but they're also very old. He did it. He bought into it. He found a way to do it. Obviously, you know about, you know, now Italy are 34 games undefeated, one away from the record. And then this is very significant, because this isn't part of Italian football culture. It's not how Italy went and, you know, won the four World Cups that Italy did win beforehand. Italy always won, as you know, by counterattacking well, by having outstanding individuals who could create something out of nothing, usually up front, by playing on the break, by defending deep and defending stout. And he realized that Italy were not equipped to do that, you know, certainly not for 90 minutes. And he chose a different way of playing, and people bought into it, and people loved it, and people had fun, and they were courageous, and they played, you know, they played with no fear. And that's something that we hadn't seen from the Italy national team in a long time. I mean, I'll tell you what, Italy won the World Cup in 2006. I thought they played very good football, but they played with fear. They used that fear to motivate them, but they were certainly not a carefree team. And they were world champions. So it's not that one way of playing is good and one way of playing is bad. It's that Mancini was able to introduce a new way of playing and was able to get results with it.
Courageous is a very good word, because if you look at Benucci and Chiellini and you look at their comparative lack of pace to most central defensive partnerships who have ambitions of winning tournaments, if you were to say to them at the off, we're going to press high, we're going to be quite attacking, Spinazzola and Di Lorenzo will flood forward at every opportunity, I could see them looking at each other thinking, well, this does not sound like we're going to have a good time. But they obviously were on board with that too.
Yeah, and I have to say, I'll hold my hand up here and say I was wrong about them. They were my biggest concern going into the tournament. I made the point that I thought, you know, maybe we should see more of Acerbi, and we did in the second and third game, or of Bastoni, of other defenders. Maybe it's a mix and match situation. Because at Juventus, they're A, Bonucci didn't have a great season. Chiellini was always injured. But they're used to defending deep. You know, they're used to just defending deep, having guys around them. Now they were asked to patrol vast areas of the pitch. Di Lorenzo has plenty of pace, of course, and is very athletic. But, you know, he really, and so did Spinazzola while he was still there. But, you know, those are fullbacks or wingbacks in the case of Spinazzola. And Mancini's system demanded that they attack up the pitch. They tweaked it a little bit. Di Lorenzo did a lot less attacking later in the competition and often became almost like a third center back, mopping things up with his pace. But yeah, that was, it's a credit to Bonucci and Chiellini, frankly, that they would go out and buy into it and find a way to make it work. Because, you know, it's one thing to tell them at 22, hey, you got to play this way. It's another thing at, you know, 34 and 36 respectively, to try and get them to play in a system that, you know, on paper is almost designed to make them look bad.
I had Chiellini all wrong before this tournament, which is a terrible thing to say about a 36-year-old. It's not like he's new on the scene here. A grizzled defender who celebrates big defensive moments. Sure, I got all that. Loves defending. I got all that. I didn't have him down as the type who would be bear-hugging Jordi Alba before a penalty shootout and seemingly has this like carefree attitude and the scenes of him giving Harry Maguire a big high five before the final as well in the tunnel. Big smile, kind of like almost a Joker type character. I did not have Chiellini in that department at all.
No, I mean, look, you're not the only one. You don't blame yourself. This jokey, slightly mad Chiellini, and it's not just Matt mind games. I've spoken to people in the camp. He's like this every day because he knows the clock is ticking on his career and he knows he's got nothing to lose. And so he says, I'm going to enjoy every moment. You know, younger Chiellini, obviously probably better Chiellini in many ways, was a different player. And he wasn't very popular with a lot of people, partly because he was a Juve guy. And, you know, unless you're a Juve fan, you most likely don't like Juventus, partly because he's the kind of guy, you know, he could be dirty and can still be dirty. But he was also somebody who was often whingy, often complaining to the referee and whatnot. And, you know, he saw it as part of his job. And again, I go back to Mancini, you know, he said, we're not going to lose our cool. We're going to try to be positive out there. I want positivity from you. And he got that in spades with Chiellini, maybe even too much with the joking and the smiling. I remember one scene, which really struck me was, I think it was an extra time. He, you know, Raheem Sterling made a great run into the Italy box. Somehow Chiellini stopped him. And afterwards, you know, Chiellini celebrated by the fist pumping, the jumping around and a big smile on his face. And even Raheem Sterling, as he was jogging back, you know, he was smiling too. Mm. You know, that kind of environment, it's hard to capture that sort of lightning in a bottle.
Yeah. I mean, look, the whole world collectively laughed at his drag back of Saka as well. And Sunday, I mean, it was comical. But you have no doubt it's improving his performances. You've captured it there perfectly. He is playing like a guy who knows the clock is ticking and I am going to enjoy every single moment. And that hangs over everything and it's evident in his performances. On Mancini and on Vialli, there was a great piece by Graeme Souness in the Sunday Times at the weekend. Souness was at Sampdoria when they were young players and Souness was an elder statesman, effectively trying to help a Sampdorian team along. That was how Souness put it anyway. And he said Mancini at 19 knew the answer to everything, had all the answers and didn't care for your Tobinsworth. And those two exchanged a lot of words on the training pitch, apparently. And he said of Vialli that Vialli was, by contrast, a student of the game. He hung on your every word. He was desperate to learn. He worked harder than Mancini, intelligent, calm, good with people. So how much have they changed in the intervening 30, 40 years?
Well, it's fun. I mean, and you mentioned Vialli there. I've written two books with him. He's somebody I know very, very well. I've known him for 25 years, lives around the corner from me here in London. I think it's an accurate portrayal that Mancini is probably a functioning introvert. You know, he's actually shy, except when he's on the pitch. When he's on the pitch, he turns into a beast. And Luca was always the more extroverted one. You know, he was the one who would talk to everybody. But probably, although hope he's not listening, would probably defer to Mancini on the pitch just because Mancini could be so intense and sometimes be a prima donna. He'd be the first player to say so. You know, Mancini's a guy who, he's the most substituted player in the history of Serie A, partly because on certain occasions when things weren't going his way or when he'd had enough, he'd ask for a change. But when you talk about Mancini, you're also talking about a guy who, when he was 16 years old, he was a starter in Serie A on a mid-table team and scored 9 goals that season, which, back then in Serie A, given how defensive it was, it's probably the equivalent of scoring 20 goals this year. He's a guy who was a household name by the time he was 12 years old. Everybody knew about sort of the phenom. I can't think of another young player in Italy who was hyped as much, while being so young. Maybe Roberto Baggio comes close, but there's nobody else. And so, he always had this sense of taking a different path and about being more gifted than everybody else, because he generally was. One of the things Mancini's talked about this is when he went into coaching, he had some of the same struggles that Glenn Hoddle had in trying to work with players, because, he would expect the players to go and then see things on the pitch the way he saw them and do things on the pitch the way he saw them. And players would look at him and see, like, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I can't hit that pass or, I'm never going to be able to see that guy, making that run. And in his words, he had to kind of unlearn football when he became a coach and relearn it from a perspective of, a mere mortal or an average professional footballer. I can think of very, very few coaches in the history of the game. Obviously, Johan Cruyff is the obvious one that I can think of. Thank you. Who were that good as footballers and also won things as coaches or managers. There's very, very few. And, I think it takes a Herculean effort to get to that point.
Yeah, it's a great point. His status in Italy, I suspect, this morning is sky high. What was it a year or two ago before this great success with Italy? How was he regarded?
He was regarded as a very good coach who, of course, delivered Inter their first title in many, many years, albeit that was in the wake of the Calciopoli scandal, which meant that, Juventus and Milan were out of commission. What's interesting, and Manchester City fans will remember this, he's remembered, and I think this is one of the things that sets him apart. He's a guy who's played very many different versions of football throughout his career. He's played quite defensive, basic football in some stops. Certainly, when he was at Manchester City, they didn't attack or play the way this Italy team plays. Obviously that came later. Certainly, upon his return to Inter a few years ago, they were much more of a much more defensive team. He really knows his football. He knows his tactics. He knows every different system, and he can tailor his system to what he wants to do in that situation. He's a tremendous coach that way, and he's been successful playing different systems and different approaches, different philosophies. And again, I think that's a real credit. He did it with attacking football this time, and maybe in a few years he'll do it with defensive football.
Pretty amazing career now. This is crowning glory moment. I mean, it's just exceptional for him. I know you were at Wembley on Sunday. As the dust settles on the madness of Wembley, what are your memories of the scenes inside? I even saw Miguel Delaney writing just this afternoon saying increasingly he looks back and thinks Wembley and all concerned very lucky something more serious didn't kick off. How out of control was it from your vantage point, Gab?
So I have a holiday booked and I do not want to test positive for COVID before that. So I got there way early. I avoided the crowds and I was inside. So I can tell you what I saw inside and some of my reporting. I did speak to a lot of people afterwards, because I know a lot of people who went to the game and you've all read their experiences. Two things struck me. One is there were very obviously far more than the official attendance there. And the reason I think is very obvious. Thousands and thousands, not hundreds, of supporters, particularly the supporters, got in. And once they were inside, they sat in seats that were assigned to other people because, of course, they had timed entry at Wembley. So there were people who broke in, I think, around 6 o'clock, if memory serves. And there were others who were due to take their seats at 7. This happened to friends of mine who, you know, husband and wife, two young kids. They get in their ticket, you know, they paid a lot of money for their tickets. They get to their seats at the appointed time. And there's four dudes sitting there and they refuse to move. And what do you do in that situation? You can go and complain to a steward on minimum wage with a little jacket who's, you know, likely to be some 18-year-old girl. What are they going to do? Very, very few cops inside the stadium. And so what the Wembley stewards did was they went and they sat them in empty seats, as you know. And again, at that point, all this COVID, social distancing, all that crap goes out the window. There's empty seats there because you had social distancing. Well, you had social distancing for a reason, because, you know, you have the highest infection rate in the world in England right now. So, you know, that goes out the window. That was an absolute shambles. And I know, I really hope there is an inquiry and people are held to account. On a personal level, I don't like the fact that, you know, a Wembley spokesman talks to my ESPN colleagues and issues a statement, you know, around 6:30 and says, oh, there was an incident with fans trying to get in, but, you know, there was no security breach and no ticketless fans are inside the stadium. I'm sorry, man. You're like the Iraqi Minister of Information. You, sir, are a liar. And whether you're willingly lying, whether you're doing it, you know, because that is the bunk information you were given by your bosses, who are too chicken crap to come out and even have the balls to say, we're still investigating what's going on. We want to ascertain the facts first. That's simply unacceptable. I want names. I want people to come out. You know, this country obviously has a history of terrible things happening at stadiums. And I know Wembley's not Hillsborough, but there's no telling what might have happened. As far as the stuff happening on Wembley Way, I watched the videos like you did. I am a bit shocked, but maybe I shouldn't have been, because similar scenes happened before the Denmark game and the Germany game. And, you know, I accept there is a portion of the support that will always behave this way. I didn't think they would do it. You know, I could see them doing it on away trips because I've seen them doing it on away trips. Didn't quite expect it, that they would do it, you know, in their home where they live. But even then, I got to take it back to the police. I can't deal with the police continually saying about how clever they are and how safe their stadiums are. And we've got this wonderful football intelligence and look, you know, we stamped out hooliganism or whatever, because you know what, on the day you weren't there. And on the day, a lot of people were scared. A lot of bad things happened. A lot of worse things could have happened. And you need to do a full inquiry as well. You know, you're very good at going to people at the Sarah Everard vigil and taking candles off of middle-aged women and threatening to arrest them and carting them away. How about you man up and go and deal with it? And don't tell me that there were 300. Oh, there were, the minimum security requirement was 300 police and there were 450. You know what? Maybe you're not that smart. Maybe 450, maybe that shouldn't be the minimum security requirement. Maybe all your clever people or experts in crowd control got that one wrong. How about you come out and own it? How about you come out and say, we done screwed up? You know, because you can't just come out and say, oh, there was a situation and we dealt with it. What the hell did you deal with? I mean, I'm sorry if I get a little annoyed, but, you know, I feel for all the fans who were there, whether they were supporting England or Italy. I feel for the other fans who went up and didn't have tickets and just thought that they would soak up the atmosphere peacefully and have a drink on Wembley Way, because these guys screwed it up for everyone.
I think your anger is well placed, to be honest with you. The whole thing was a thundering disgrace and could have been so much worse. And a few thoughts. This is a country very practiced in hosting big, big games, so there shouldn't have been any issue. Secondly, it was obvious, even to me sitting in Dublin, just looking at my phone early on, and I mean early on, that London was bubbling and not going in the right direction. So even if they were under-resourced, how they didn't pull in extra resources by 5, 6, 7 o'clock is beyond me. Simon Cooper described the tube station after the game, and it was anarchy, and trying to get home was crazy, and again, COVID was the least of your problems, but it was a super spreader type situation in that tube station. And there was just this air of lawlessness, which must have been terrifying for a bunch of people, like your friends. What do you do when someone is in your seat? I mean, do you confront them? Some people did confront, and that led to messy scenes. I mean, a few of the journalists have made the point that if Luke Shaw hadn't scored early and just lifted the mood and almost proved the great distraction, things could have got ugly. And then the other obvious point, going back to your opening point, is if there had been a capacity crowd at Wembley, then things would have been a whole lot more serious. They are incredibly lucky there was not a capacity crowd there.
No, they locked gates while people were coming in. They got this all wrong, and there were shades of this, again, just a couple days earlier against Denmark, and what, 10 days earlier against Germany. And this is important because we've all come through a 16 months nightmare, which isn't over yet. And in these situations, we've had to put our trust in our governments and our trust in authority and trust that they made the right decisions. And maybe some were right, some were wrong, I'm sure they were mostly made in good faith. But there has to be accountability to go with it. Because when there is no accountability, when there are essentially cover-ups, that's when you lose faith in authority. You know, why do I have to go listen to some dude just because he has a badge if I don't trust him? You know, that's when things break apart. And that's why I expect, and maybe I'm naive, but I have faith that there will be a serious inquiry into this. This is not a political thing. It's not a Tory Labour thing or whatever. You know, it wasn't Boris Johnson in charge of the logistics, but there has to be accountability. And, you know, while it's very important to go and have a debate, all these other debates that have been happening, right, people in Italy are incensed that the players took off their medals, the silver plate medals, many of them, as soon as they got them, they thought that was disrespectful. Fine, let's have a debate over that. The talk of racism and visiting number 10, obviously hugely important. But there has to be room to also debate everything that went wrong, because, you know, that could have cost lives, you know, right in the here and there. And that goes much further, in my opinion.
One last point to put to you then before we let you go. There's something just incredibly interesting happening with footballers the last couple of years through their social media accounts, I suppose. Predominantly, Tyrone Mings called out Priti Patel in perfect and succinct fashion. She had been talking about the fans' right to boo the knee and describing the booing of the knee as an example of gesture politics, I would think, less than 2 weeks ago, and then suddenly she's to the fore condemning the racism, and Tyrone Mings held a mirror up to that hypocrisy quite beautifully. And then Marcus Rashford, I mean, it's amazing, even over here you have, you wouldn't know Vincent Brown, sorry it's a silly thing to bring up, but he's like a brilliant political commentator, broadcaster here, and even he, you know, I don't think he'd be that into Marcus Rashford generally, and he was tweeting about how he must be the most admired person in England at the moment. It was one of those moments. I opened my phone this morning and saw Vincent Brown tweeting about Marcus Rashford and thought, my goodness, this is big, and something interesting is happening here. I mean, you can take it any way you want to take it, but what jumps out to me at the moment is you now have this very vociferous bunch of footballers, very clued in, and you would have to say they're pretty close to the most high profile and powerful, I guess it's soft power, but power nonetheless, powerful bunch of working class and black or people of colour in English life at the moment. And they're sticking it to the government on a fairly routine basis, and the whole country is watching it happen. What are you making of all this? Just the last couple of days, Gab, and then a little bit beyond, because it's been brewing now for a lot of the last 18 months.
I mean, it's an interesting situation. I followed closely what happens across the pond in the US, where obviously a lot of this stuff originated, and where you've had high profile athletes speaking out there for some time as well. You know, I think none of these people who speak out as athletes are obviously experts in this stuff, in terms of the political aspects. They're not politicians, they're not policy experts, they're not scientists. their people. And I always feel that when Marcus Rashford talks about stuff, and this is where his critics get it wrong, he's talking about school meals for deprived children because he was a deprived child who relied on school meals. He's talking about what it means to be a Black man in England in 2021 because he is a Black man in England in 2021. He's not giving advice on monetary policy. And so for me, those people who talk about, you know, stick to sports, stick to what you know, he's sticking to what he knows. As for the Priti Patel stuff, again, I think Tyrone Mings doesn't need to be a politician to point out when a politician tries to score points with a certain sector of the public. I can give you my own personal view that if Priti Patel had simply said, if people want to boo, that is their right, I wouldn't have an issue with it from her perspective. Mm. When she starts talking about the gesture itself, you can't have it both ways. You can't go out and say, you can't say that taking a knee is virtue signaling and the people who boo it are justified in booing it, not just have a right, but are justified in booing it, and then go and condemn racism. No. Because few people have contributed to this poisonous discourse as much as she has. And look, I also feel that it's not just her. I mean, I don't want to get political. I was struck, and I'll just mention this very quickly. There's a man named Dominic Raab, who's a member of cabinet here, who's managed to keep a very, very low profile on this issue, because he's more intelligent than others, after saying something which I thought was absolutely offensive and despicable at the start of this whole thing. When he was asked about taking a knee, you know, he made a stupid joke saying now he would only do it when he proposes to his wife or for his queen, fair enough. And he said, well, what is that? Something out of Game of Thrones. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, you're either a complete ignoramus who hasn't been paying any attention to the news for the past, you know, for the past 12 months, that you don't know what it is and why people do it, that you think that it's something from Game of Thrones, or you're just a really bad, vile person who thinks that you can turn something that is so important and so painful to so many people that they feel they have to do it into your stupid Game of Thrones joke. You know, it's one or the other. And already that is what has divided so many people. You know, if the gesture itself, all the other stuff, the BLM stuff, again, if you want to know where it came from, it comes from a white army veteran who was a Green Beret, a man named Nate Boyer recommending this to an American football player named Colin Kaepernick like 3 years ago. He felt the need to protest during the playing of the national anthem. He said, look, this is a respectful way to do it. I, as somebody who has served my country in the military, who doesn't share your views because I'm very conservative, say to you, if you want to highlight the problem, take a knee. And it says, there is a problem here. That is what the gesture means. And that is at the heart of everything. Dominic Raab doesn't know that. I presume he does now. But to go and politicize this and bring in the Marxism and all this other nonsense, destruction of the nuclear family, it's just ridiculous. And people should know better. And people can have whatever thoughts they want, but they can't then go and score points and, you know, lament the racism and we've gone so far. No.
No.
Just shut up and get on with your job and try to be the best Priti Patel you can be.
Yeah. It's just very interesting to see where it all goes. I mean, misplaced power it may be, but those footballers now, in calling her out, generate more headlines and more attention than every single Labour politician calling her out for the next 24 hours straight, we wouldn't be talking about it if Mings hadn't tweeted it. That's the really interesting dynamic at the moment, that they are representatives. Again, misplaced it may be, kicking a football around a pitch gives you that platform, but they're using it like no generation before them. Gab, could talk to you for another hour, but we can't, sadly. Thanks so much. Much appreciated. Gab Marcotti, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power's Save Our Game. Is your bookie giving you jack? Then you haven't tried Paddy Power. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Okay, so you're welcome back. If you're just tuning in, brilliant stuff from Gab Marcotti there just before the ad break. Well worth listening back to on podcast or on our social channels. Football on Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power's Save Our Game. The England goals totaled a massive €110,000 for Irish football, all with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. We're turning to Lionel Messi, a winner at last with Argentina after they beat Brazil in the Copa final at the weekend. 16 years after his debut, he has suffered three Copa final defeats, a World Cup final defeat, and finally, against Brazil in the Maracanã, he won a major tournament, fell to the floor in relief. And he said afterwards, I can't tell you how happy I feel. Very happy to say Marcela Mora Iorahu is with us on the line. At last, Marcela.
At last, yes. I can't tell you how happy I feel. Yes, very good news. It was a long time coming. And I think it's very much Messi's triumph, Messi's victory. One could say Argentina needed the trophy, the country, the mood, but it's very much his achievement. And you could tell on the pitch, the players wanting it to be for him, especially the last few seconds of play. There's a real energy on the pitch going on, and a lot of people in Argentina saying, I wanted this for Messi more than anything. So it feels like it was very much Messi's crowning glory, literally, quite literally.
There aren't too many instances in football where it is all about one player, but this genuinely was one of them. The coach afterwards just spoke about Messi and what it meant for Messi and how Messi had played with an injury and, you know, Messi's the greatest. And the players at full time, effectively not long after full time, went to Messi and started throwing him in the air in recognition of his contribution. It is so rare where this very selfish sport is about one player, but such is his greatness. Saturday revolved around him. It was all about him.
Yes, I think, I mean, in Argentina, we've often had this discussion about Maradona and whether Maradona won on his own, whether the team, that kind of interaction between Maradona and the rest of the players in 86 and so on. But I think what was going on with Messi now is in this age of everybody knowing all the time what's going on, especially at club level. So Messi was doing so well with Barcelona. He'd won everything possible individually at club level. And there was this kind of pending assignment with Argentina. And so he became at once the player with the most minutes played this year for Argentina, refusing to go off the pitch at any point, wanting to play absolutely every game, but also a player that was not at all present in what is known as the renovation in Argentina at the moment, which is this kind of new blood, if you like, or a new structure to the Football Association and to the first team of the internationals, where Lionel Scaloni was unexpectedly appointed as an interim manager after the 2018 fiasco when Sampaoli left. And Scaloni, nobody thought would remain particularly long and had no pedigree, no experience. You know, nobody, including me, really thought that much would come off it. But it just felt like a quiet, a nice, calm time when, you know, that he could maybe work with a few players that were young, that were home-based. And Messi didn't appear at all in that formula. And then there was this team that was ready and he slipped into it. So I think for the young players, it was very much about throwing him up in the air and saying, look, we were finally the system that could let you thrive, the one that none of, you know, the previous Argentina teams had managed. And for the older ones, his contemporaries, the old guard, Otamendi, Di Maria, Aguero, it was about sharing with him this thing that had eluded them, just eluded them so many times. And in fact, there's a poetic justice about Di Maria scoring as well, because he was really questioned and subject of loads of aggressions from the media, from people. You know, he was he really, really took the brunt of the what would some would call failures, and one can only say of all the other times they excelled and reached finals and then just didn't win them. But there was a perfect balance, I think, of old and new.
Yes.
Really nice. Very, very, very good. And I think it's interesting that his club performance, or not performance particularly, but his relationship with Barcelona, you know, waning over the past season and now literally kind of ending formally his contract while he was playing for Argentina. So it's almost like this thing was lifted off him, and you know, the free agent on paper, free agent on the pitch. Mm. He was really a very liberated man, being able to do what he does best.
Marcella, I noted that he has passed Mascherano's record of 150 appearances, so he's at 151. And the story goes, and I don't know how true it is, but it's what we've heard for years, that there is maybe a slightly lukewarm aspect to the relationship between Messi and the Argentinian people. Or if maybe lukewarm is the wrong way of putting it, it's certainly not the visceral adoration that they have for Maradona and the relationship they have for Maradona. I would think if there has been a lukewarm aspect to his relationship, that he is playing every minute, as you say, in his mid-30s for the cause, that he is breaking Mascherano's appearance record, and that he has won this tournament at this stage of his career, that should cement a certain bond and a certain affection there now, no?
Absolutely. I mean, I think rather than a lukewarm relationship with Argentina, which is a very broad category of people to have a relationship with, I think there has been a questioning of his Argentinianness and his commitment. And you know, fans, that we're the same all over the world, I think. So even Mascherano, who was a hero in 2014 and super respected and kind of had memes of, you know, Che Guevara with Mascherano's face going viral, then became the target of a lot of quite hostile and aggressive vitriol. Messi took it more than any. He's been booed on the pitch. People have been questioning his commitment to, you know, saying, oh, for Barcelona he does this, for Argentina he doesn't appear, he doesn't run, he doesn't turn up at crucial moments. I think that's quietened down completely now, because, you know, it's the immediate emotional aftermath of the victory. But also there's a whole generation who had not seen an Argentina win something important, and now they have. And so for them, there won't be this questioning or this relentless comparison with Maradona, because they didn't, you know, not many, but there are kids in Argentina aged 12 and below who might say, who is Maradona, when everybody's kind of going,
sure.
And no one now is going to say who is Messi of that age group. So he has cemented something going forward as well. And there will be critics, and there will be people, real football fans who are fans of their club beyond Argentina as well. You know, he isn't adored and revered by everybody, but it's worth saying, nor was Maradona. There are a lot of people in Argentina that really didn't like Maradona at all, on the football pitch, you know, as a player. So Maradona was extremely divisive. I don't know that Messi's as divisive a personality. I think there was just this sense that if he could achieve so much for Barcelona, how come he couldn't do it for Argentina?
Yes.
And
yes,
that's been put to bed, A, by him at doing it for Argentina, B, by there being a younger type of football fan that is a lot less kind of testosterone driven about winning, and, you know, and who have accepted him as an Argentine hero even without winning any trophies for Argentina. But this is a really good way of silencing them, because now he's also given them this.
Yeah, copper fastens the relationship. He's no longer the boy who was plucked by Barcelona and never delivered for Argentina, quote-unquote, never delivered. And it would have been so different if he had retired as planned after that 2016 Copa defeat. So this has been a very, very sweet Indian summer for him and Argentina. And I suppose, Marcella, it does beg the question, Italy are European champions and have looked a very, very good team. Argentina, as you said, they haven't won anything in a long time. Their first Copa in 28 years. The World Cup is just around the corner by comparison with normal times. Are Argentina a force to be reckoned with 35-year-old Messi leading this young bunch?
I think if Messi's body's up to it physically, which he has said, if, you know, as long as I can physically do it, I want to carry on playing, then for sure, because that we've seen some really interesting talent emerging as well. So what needs to happen is that the, you know, rather toxic and complicated stuff that goes on around football, as Bielsa used to say, you know, everything that hasn't got to do with football is unbearable in at international level. If that doesn't kind of drain the energy like it did in 2018, then Scaloni has got a great team. He's got Walter Samuel and Pablo Aimar, who are two of the absolute bestest players we've ever had at international level, and who are now working incredibly well with the training youths and training, you know, the main team, and a really nice dynamic going on. I mean, I was thinking this over the weekend and seeing everything that was going on with England as well. I wonder to what extent the fact that Brazil is absolutely closed its borders, so there's not only no fans in the stadium, but actually hardly any journalists from Argentina traveled, if that's given them a kind of you know, slight bubble effect that's allowed them to work really well. And I wonder to what extent leading up to the World Cup they'll get the same thing, because I think the media dynamic is quite intense there. And in fact, they did, when they were celebrating and singing, the players at the Maracanã, they were singing against the journalists. And there's a very lovely moment when they start trying to sing against the Brazilians, and then Messi says no, and walks away, and they have to, they're not allowed to be anti-Brazilian, but they are allowed to be anti-media. So you know, the concepts of who we are for and against are shifting. But it could be a really good Qatar World Cup with a really exciting England young team as well. So it might be that we redefine the England-Argentina fixture as well and turn it into a lovely moment where they all end up embraced and, you know, sharing a giggle instead of shouting obscenities at each other.
Well, listen,
like Messi and Neymar did.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's good to hear journalists are reviled all around the world, Marcella. Great for our profession. Good to know. Thanks so much for your time. Always great to have you on, Marcella Mora-Irahe. Thanks, Marcella.
Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power's Save Our Game. England's goals totaled 110k for Irish football. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.